with the revival of interest in classical literature, we see at the time of the Renaissance an emergence of textual criticism, and a name that you must be familiar with, crucial in terms of the results of textual criticism, Lorenzo Valla, 1406-1456. I'm pointing to him on the board up here. With Petrarch, the father of humanism, and then Valla, who perhaps is one of the greatest of the textual critics. Textual criticism is an attempt to study the variance between different documents of the same text to determine genuineness or the superiority of one textual tradition over another. Valla's accomplishment as a textual critic is that he examined what was called at that time the Donation of Constantine. Say, well, what's the big deal with the Donation of Constantine? Well, the Donation of Constantine was a document which allegedly legitimated the transference of temporal authority to the Pope, that Constantine had granted to the Pope to have the right to govern political affairs. And this document was referred to over and over again by the church as legitimating that authority. Well, Valla did a textual critical study of the donation, that is the document called the donation. He found that it mentioned things from many, many years after the period in which it was supposed to have been written. And that certain things that would naturally have been mentioned in that period of time were not mentioned in the document, though they were pertinent to what the document was all about. And so he drew the conclusion that the Donation of Constantine was spurious, was a forgery. The significance of that is that Rome, for all these years, exercising political tyranny, no longer had a legitimation for what it was doing. With this came textual criticism of a number of things, including the Latin Vulgate, study of the textual tradition that had dominated the Roman Catholic Church. Those who were doing textual criticism, and those who were reviving ancient learning, by the way, considered themselves pious men. They thought that they were simply purifying Christian doctrine, rehabilitating it. The humanism of these early days was not an out-and-out assault against the faith. Though the seeds of that assault may have been there, that was not the conscious motivation of these men. I think you have to keep that in mind. What happened with the advent of textual criticism is that men realized that they could use their own independent, that is, me as a separate scholar, could use their own independent reasoning ability to question what the church was teaching on alleged authority. Does that sound familiar to any of you Protestants out there? Because you see, this comes to become the Protestant spirit, that the church may say something, but I have the right to go to the text and critically analyze it. Now, whether that means as to its genuineness as a historical object or a document, or as to what it is actually claiming, and to compare the teaching of the church to the text of the scripture. This is beneficial for the Reformation, but many people would say that is the Reformation is just the halfway house, if you will, to the idea that you are, as an individual, authoritative in yourself. You see, once we have been cut free from the authority of the church, the Donation of Constantine and so forth, and now we are looking at the text of Scripture, we need to be cut free from the text of Scripture and become independent men in ourselves. But that is a process of development, and I am not arguing that the early textual critics were, you know, anti-Christian. Yes, sir. We're going to come to that. Vala 1406, 1456. Okay, now, Vala dies in 1456. 3 years prior to that, Constantinople had fallen to the Turks. Again, what a period of time. Amazing things going on. Okay, fourthly, in terms of cultural effects of the Renaissance, we've looked at exploration, money power, the revival of learning. Fourthly, we see the development, and this is just a natural concomitant, hardly surprising, a new image of the value of man. A new image of the value of man. This is perhaps nowhere better illustrated than in Pico della Mirandola's Oration on the Dignity of Man. I've listed him as Pico here, Pico della Mirandola. Let me see his dates. He was born in 1462, and I do not have a date of death. 1462. But he's born 30 years before Columbus sails. Anyway, his Oration on the Dignity of Man tells you something just by the title, right? He tells us that man is an independent, rational being, that he has value, that human personality has a respect about it and a pride about it that we should recognize. Let me read a little bit from his oration. Thou, constrained by no limits in accordance with thine own free will, in whose hand we have placed thee, shalt ordain for thyself the limits of thy nature. We have set thee at the world's center, that thou mayest from thence more easily observe whatever is in the world. Man's at the center of the world, he's to observe it, he is free to make of himself whatever he will be. Let a certain holy ambition invade our souls, so that not content with the mediocre, we shall pant after the highest, and since we may, if we wish, toil with all our strength to obtain it. Okay, in our day and age where, you know, every Tom, Dick, and Harry is out there promoting this idea, you can do it, you know, self-help seminars, get ahead, you know, visualize and all that sort of thing. This may seem mundane, but the time of the Renaissance, you know, it's no longer you are a guilty sinner coming to the priest for absolution. It's now you've got dignity, man. You can do something. You don't have to be mediocre. Go for it. You can accomplish whatever you want. Continue reading. Then let us fill our well-prepared and purified soul with the light of natural philosophy so that we may at last perfect her in the knowledge of things divine. Okay. Our purified soul must now study natural philosophy that it may be perfected. Here's a new image of man, the humanistic ideal of man with his pride and his autonomy. He will study the classics of literature so that he'll broaden himself individually. He'll learn to put an emphasis on those things human. He will de-emphasize the supernatural. And now see himself in the center of the natural world and concerned with it. One of the most influential of the schools of the Renaissance that became that came to be founded was founded by Vittorino da Feltre, F-E-L-T-R-E, whose dates are 1397 to 1446. And the reason I mention him, I think, yeah, Vittorino I have up here after Petrarch and before Vala, is that the ideal that was promoted in this school and which caught on throughout Europe, you know, noblemen sent their children down, you know, to be educated at Vittorino's school, is he wanted to produce the well-rounded individual. It is not important that he be a nobleman. What's important is that the student be a gentleman. And the gentleman advances in, the ability to fence, the ability to be a good soldier, but not a soldier like you might think of a soldier, you know. And I'm not trying to put soldiers down as a class. Don't accuse me of hasty generalization. But you all know, we generally think of the enlisted man as a guy who likes to get drunk on the weekends. He doesn't do a whole lot of, you know, highbrow reading and so forth, or going to concerts. Or if he does, they're heavy metal concerts, that sort of thing, right? But the well-rounded individual of the Renaissance school was a person who read the classics. Okay, I don't know. Some of you guys may remember... I'm not sure. What deodorant company was it? Boz would be out there, and here's this guy who's this really, you know, tough guy, and he has this reputation, but now he's speaking, you know, with an air of sophistication and genteelness and so forth. Now, that is a caricature. I mean, it's an attempt to bring a laugh, but that is kind of your Renaissance man, the man who is brutal on the battlefield, but he goes home to read Plato and Aristotle, and he listens to classical music. He's well-rounded, you see. He develops his body, he develops his mind, and he develops his soul. He's a moral person. He's not a person of license and indulgence. He understands moderation. And again, it's not important that you come from a wealthy family, though it's wealthy families that could send their children to a school like this. Vittorino, by the way, would take in a number of children from poverty-stricken families and educate them, because he believed, what? In the perfectibility of human nature. It's not important that you come from a noble lineage. What's important is that you become educated and develop your inherent abilities as a man. You see this especially in Castiglione's Book of the Courtier. Castiglione, 1478-1529. He's down here at the bottom of the first column. Okay, so again, you see the inner spacing of these different people we're talking about. Castiglione particularly advanced the idea that the courtier is a man of arms, he's a man who's courageous, and yet he's a man who is gentle. In public, he's reserved, he is modest. And literature adorns his mind. He's conversant with the Latin language and with Greek. He's proficient in writing poetry. Don't you love this? Well, what am I talking about here? Have you ever heard the expression, the Renaissance man? Well, this is your Renaissance man. You see, he's well-rounded. He can do everything. Kind of MacGyver, you know, just put him in any situation, and he knows the situation, he knows the language, he knows just what to do. He's just as good with the tuxedo as he is in a, you know, a coat of arms. And he knows his culture. This is interesting, from the Book of the Courtier. The courtier must be proficient in writing verse and prose, especially in this, well, it says vulgar tongue. You know what that means, not vulgar as we take it, but in the common tongue. For besides the enjoyment he will find in it, he will by this means never lack agreeable entertainment with ladies who are usually fond of such things. And so you see, he has his way with the feminine world as well, because they'll be impressed with his knowledge of the classics and his sophistication, but his manliness on the field of battle and so forth. He's a man who knows painting and music and all the rest. Well, are you getting the point here? The Renaissance man. You have a new image of man. His pride, his autonomy, oration on the dignity of man. You know, the courtier, the well-rounded individual. And above all, the Renaissance man is individualistic. He's a man who has a well-rounded life, and that will include religion. But it's not a religion, you know, see, that bows the knee. It's not a religion that humbles itself, but it's a religion that sees in the divine, in the mystical, in that which is beyond man, simply the perfection of human nature. Man, you see, is not to emphasize his weakness, his inadequacy, his sin, his guilt. He is to emphasize his dignity, his potential, the greatness and grandeur of what he can become and what he can produce. And so throughout the Renaissance, I hope you can see in its explorations, in the rise of the power of money, in the revival of learning, and in the new image of man and his value, a stress on the individual and his freedom, what he can accomplish. Man is great. And if we don't see the greatness, it's simply because he hasn't been put in the right surroundings. He hasn't been educated properly. And if he could just learn the classics, then his goodness would come out of him. Hey, Jay. No, that's fine. If I forgot to give them or if you didn't catch them, no problem. Oh, 1397 to 1446. Did I say that wrong?
No, I just want to make
sure. Okay. 1397 to 1446. Okay, if these are some of the cultural characteristics of the Renaissance, I'm going to reverse the order in your outline, pardon me. Let's go to the political theorizing of the Renaissance now and look at something of the new political ideal that is developed along with this Renaissance man and his greatness. First of all, the Renaissance is known as a period of rising nationalism. The localism of the medieval world is being dissolved, not only by the Crusades that took people to foreign lands, but all the more by this spirit of exploration. Printing made possible the development of literature in vernacular languages widespread among a people. And particularly, we find certain political leaders, especially in France and in England, who were shrewd and self-reliant. Often the leaders, the kings of these areas, were men who had gained great military might and fiscal prowess as well with the trading that went on in their domain. They acquired the right to levy taxes beyond the great estates of the noblemen in their realm, and they would directly tax the people. We see the beginning of the rise of national armies, not just armies for a particular landholder. And these armies would be paid and they would be professionally trained to fight together, to defend all the noblemen, not just the particular estate from which you arose or where your family was located. Many times these shrewd and power-aggrandizing kings would not care too terribly much about the morals of those that they appointed under them. They didn't care about traditional morality. They were so cynical that as long as the person that they appointed brought them power and accomplished what they wanted, they didn't care. And you have here the beginning of what is now a dominant tradition in politics. You make sure your underlings get your dirty work done. Just don't tell me how you do it. Okay. We see this in Louis the 11th in France, Henry the 7th of England. They came eventually to assert their supremacy as sovereigns in a secular realm over against the supremacy that the church held over the souls and lives of individuals. Eventually, Henry VIII, you know the story, came to have a quarrel with the Church of Rome over the issue of his divorce from Catherine of Aragon. And something that would have been unheard of previously happened. When Henry didn't get his way, he was no longer satisfied to be simply sovereign in terms of the secular interest of England, but he now asserted his sovereignty over the church as well. And so the Reformation, as it comes to England, is a special case study because the Reformation doesn't start with an interest in dogmatical reform, as you see it, say, in a Luther or a Calvin. It's an interest in getting the Pope out of the affairs of the English church, but not because the Pope worships improperly or violates Scripture, but because the Pope won't grant and submit to the sovereignty of Henry. This is a new spirit in politics. In many ways, not better than the spirit of the Middle Ages, just a different kind of wickedness, if you will. Because though I don't approve as a Protestant of the Pope's tyranny in the Middle Ages and the corruption of doctrine and worship and all the rest that we find there, it's no advantage to turn the church over to the sovereignty of a selfish, you know, licentious, greedy man like Henry VIII. That's not the answer. You get rid of one tyrant and replace it with another. But nevertheless, the Reformation in England, you know, begins with that. In 1534, Parliament passed the Act of Supremacy that made the king head of the English church. So I have Henry VIII here, down with Calvin and Thomas More. We'll come back to look at them later.
Can you give us the date of Henry VIII?
Well, I'm using as the date of flourishing 1534, and I'm not sure I put in my notes more than that. No. 1534, because that's when he asserted his supremacy in the church. Henry next dissolved the monasteries in England. And where did the land holdings and the valuables of the monasteries go? To his noblemen. And so what he did here, now, we're so accustomed to this, we take it for granted, but we ought to scoff at this with indignation. What Henry did is he asserts his sovereignty and then he cements the loyalty of people by what? Buying them. Exactly. It's a big payoff. And who suffers? Now, I don't favor the monks and their orders and all that, but I don't think it's right to go and seize the monasteries either and turn them over and their holdings to your noblemen. But this begins, you see, a centralizing tendency in political affairs. A new notion of sovereignty that the king has, and an almost amoral exercise of power. So let's go back and think about this for a minute. Let's go back to the time of Dante. Dante asserted the independence of the temporal power of the civil ruler. Dante's dates are 1265 to 1321. Okay, if you look up here at the board just for a second, see Dante's way up here on the first column. I have just been talking about Henry VIII over here. But what Henry VIII did in his day, you see, was made possible by the development of a new approach to politics that we'll see in Dante, Marsiglio, Machiavelli, and so forth. So I want to kind of develop that for you a little bit. In Dante, we see an assertion that was novel for his day of the independence of the temporal power of the state. He wrote a famous treatise, De Monarchia, the King. Prior to Dante, of course, the Middle Ages had taught that kings are all subject to what? The Pope, to the spiritual power of the Church that comes to expression in God's vicar on earth, the Pope, Peter's successor. Dante believed, however, that the authority of the Pope should be confined to spiritual matters. Well, how can he argue that? Haven't you ever heard of the donation of Constantine? Constantine himself turned over temporal authority to the Pope. But now you already know the problem with that, right? That was a forgery. Anyway, Dante, see, he's up here, Valla is down here. What could Dante do to argue for the restriction of the Pope's power apart from, you know, disproving the donation of Constantine? Well, Dante argued as a good Thomist. He tried to take Thomist premises and turn them to a conclusion other than what Thomas Aquinas would have come to. According to Dante, the ultimate purpose of political association is tranquility and peace. Only when we have tranquility and peace in society can men perform those activities which is true to their nature and that can bring about happiness for them. And how is it that people can live in peace? Now, this is a what we would call a utilitarian or consequentialist form of argument. He's saying man is supposed to pursue happiness, especially the divine happiness, the beatific vision. But how can men do that? How can they freely pursue those things for which they were made if they don't have peace as their social circumstance? Now, I hope you're all sympathetic, even if you don't agree with this argument. You can understand it. Do you think that it's easy to worship God in Bosnia these days? You know, if you don't have outward tranquility, it's very difficult to pursue those pious ends for which we think man was made. Okay, so man, if he's going to glorify God, needs to live in a civil state that brings tranquility and peace. And the way in which members of a society can gain tranquility and peace is to have someone rule and regulate them. Okay? If everyone's living for himself anarchistically, then you aren't going to have tranquility and peace. So we have to have somebody who rules over men to bring this about. Now, if it turns out that in order to have peace in your home, there must be a head of the house, and if you're going to have peace in your village, there's got to be a head over the village. If you're going to have tranquility in your province, there needs to be a head over your province, right? And tranquility then in your, what we will now call states, although that's anachronistic, you need a king. And if kings would have tranquility among themselves, then they need an emperor. Okay? This is an easy argument. It's like, if I prove it on the local level, then I can prove it at this level and on up. And so it turns out that we need a head over kings for the welfare of the world. The peace and prosperity of the local domain is dependent upon the peace and prosperity and the welfare of the world as a whole. And so a universal secular sovereign is the indispensable condition of peace, which is itself the condition for man pursuing his highest end. Okay, now you're a Roman Catholic. You're going to hear this argument and you're going to say, oh, only one problem. That doesn't have to be a secular sovereign. Why can't the Pope be the person that you have just proven? And after all, Dante, haven't you heard of the donation of Constantine? And so Dante had to argue further. He had to have an answer for what would be given back by the Roman Catholics. And I think you'll enjoy this. I'm a Protestant. I think this is interesting. He says, well, the donation of Constantine is interesting, but it's part of church tradition. Church tradition is subordinate to the church itself. Obviously, church tradition doesn't authorize the church because the church precedes its tradition. That makes sense. Isn't that commonsensical to you? Well, if the donation of Constantine is part of the tradition of the church, then the donation of Constantine cannot establish the nature of the church. The church must prove its authority not from the donation of Constantine, but from Scripture. And there is no authority for the head of the church in temporal affairs in Scripture. And therefore, Dante argued, according to the Bible, there are really two swords. One, a temporal sword in the hand of the emperor, and another, a spiritual sword in the hand of Peter and his successors. What's juicy about this argument is that you have somebody using medieval premises to prove a Protestant conclusion. Here's Dante, way back here, arguing for a separate, what we will now call a separation of church and state, and get this, telling the Roman Catholics, you've got to go to Scripture to prove your point. Dante was no Protestant. In his convictions, he was thoroughly Roman Catholic. He was a Thomist and so forth. And yet he uses the premises of Thomistic philosophy to come to what are essentially Protestant conclusions about the authority of the church and the church's place in society. Well, you mustn't miss that. That is a big step in the history of Western thought. So Dante wanted to free the power of politics from ecclesiastical domination, and he was willing to leave both the church and the state as equal powers under God. Now, what distinguishes the church from the state? They both have power. The principle of distinction, according to Dante, was time and eternity. The state has authority in temporal matters, time. The church has authority in eternal matters. And while that is the sort of thing, whether stated or just implicit, many Protestants might say, that is not, I think, a helpful way to distinguish the authority of the church and the state. Both the church and the state are interested in temporal issues, and both the church and the state should be interested in eternal issues. What distinguishes them is what the sovereign over both of them dictates as to their function and the way that they pursue it. Okay? Is this an important distinction? I hope you see that it is, because the minute you say the state has dominion in temporal matters, then what will happen in Western history is, having been dominated by the spiritual, quote-unquote, authority of the Pope, we are opening up in Western history, through this new Renaissance approach to politics, the idea of the tyranny of a temporal sovereign, not the church. But now the king is going to dominate all temporal affairs. Has God given authority to the state in all temporal affairs? No, he hasn't. But wouldn't you say that most people today think that if there's some problem in history, anything that happens in culture, the state has the right to butt its nose into it? Okay, so way back in the time of Dante, you may not have seen that, but you see, the seed is sown for that kind of tyranny when you draw a false distinction. It's not a time-eternity distinction, but that's what Dante did. Well, if Dante asserted the independence of the temporal power of the state, Marsiglio asserted the supremacy of the temporal power of the state. Marsiglio, let me see if I can find some dates for him here. 1274 to 1343. Okay, so Dante was born in 1265. About a decade later, Marsiglio is born. Marsiglio goes beyond, however, the thinking of Dante. He wishes to see the power, the temporal power of the state, as supreme. According to him, Occam and Averroes were right in their double truth thesis. There's a truth in theology, there's a truth in philosophy. That being the case, we are free to develop a political theory, a philosophy of politics that has nothing to do with theological considerations. We can have a completely rational or secular approach now to politics. According to Marsiglio, the state is an organism. And the organism is healthy when all the parts of the organism play their appropriate role. Isn't that right? In the body, I happen to think about this because recently I've gained the diagnosis of diabetes. When the pancreas is doing what it's supposed to do, then you have health in the body. When the pancreas doesn't do its role, it's not as though you have, you know, like, what would that be, 1/50th of the body and its weight or something like that. I'm not sure of the actual numbers. It's not as though you just have, you know, one part of the body that's not working well. You're sick throughout your body. And so it is in the state. If every part of the organism does what it's supposed to do, then you have health. You got to make sure that every part does what it's supposed to do then. And he rested this argument on Aristotle. Aristotle had originally advanced it. Aristotle was right in what he had said. But guess what? When Aristotle wrote this, there was no Christian church. Whoa! If there was no Christian church, and Aristotle had it right back then you know what? We don't need the Christian church to make the state work right now. Okay, question. Every faction within the state, every group of men, families, merchants, farmers, so forth, but also every individual, every citizen of the state must perform his proper role. So then you have health throughout the body. It's really, as I was just indicating, an ancient metaphor or figure of speech for the state. And what Marsiglio points out is that we need to find the proper function then of the clergy. We're going to use this Aristotelian argument and we just have to update it with, now where do the clergy come in? Well, we have a double truth approach here, right? You have philosophy on the one hand, theology on the other. What does theology tell us? Do you love it? Once you get people who have the double truth approach, then you'll find that they'll arbitrarily argue on this side philosophically for what they want, and then when that doesn't suit their purposes, then they go over here and they pick up what they want from this. But now this side, the theological side, may teach them things they don't want, so then they give that up and they go back over here. Well, Marsiglio had this down very well. Philosophically, he proves you need to have, you know, the temporal power of the state. And by the way, you can prove that without any consideration of the church. But what's the church all about? Well, what do we read over here theologically? I said, which way are you going to go here? Well, he says, over here, theologically, we learn that the priest exists for the sake of man's eternal salvation. That has nothing to do with the state. So, yeah, they've got their proper place. But keep it over here in theology, things of eternity. Remember the dichotomy that I put up here? The church has to do with faith, has to do with theology, has to do with grace. But over here in the mundane area of reason and the state, you have the emperor. And so there is no special place for the clergy, no special place for theology in any philosophy of the state, according to Marsiglio. And so Dante had a separation of church and state. It didn't look too bad. He made some mistakes, but he had a pretty good idea. Marsiglio has a separation of theology and philosophy. In the realm of the state, which is a natural institution, you have to have philosophy reigning. You don't bring theology into it at all. Pete?
Does the state establish the moral?
Yes. the state has a secular point of view, and what is supposed to take place and the laws that are found in the state are to be secular laws. And so I'm glad you bring this up. Let me quote from Marsiglio. Divine law is a command of God directly without human deliberation about voluntary acts. Human law is a command of the whole body of citizens or its prevailing part, arising directly from the deliberation of those empowered to make law. Okay? So divine law is one thing, theology, but human laws are what the people make up. What worries me when I teach at the end of the 20th century, even to a, you know, a bright group like this at Christ College, is that you hear that and you say, yeah, ho-hum, so what? Everybody knows that. You shouldn't know that because it isn't true. But it has been taken for granted in our generation that human law, that which is made for secular society, is just what the people have to say. You notice he's got, remember that dichotomy I was telling you? He's got that steel wall in there. Divine law up here, human law down here. What is characteristic of human law, according to Marsiglio, is rationality, not dependence upon supernatural intervention or guidance. A human law is simply a command of the people. And whatever command of the people cannot be enforced is not law at all. It's just an entreaty, an exhortation. So what does this mean? This means that law is power. It's what the people decree and what they can enforce. Without that power of enforcement, there is no law. Now, I happen to agree with them that there is a distinction between an exhortation, an entreaty, and a law. And the distinction is just this, that the law is followed with sanctions. The law is, if you will, empowered by punishments and rewards and so forth. However, according to him, the power of enforcement is that of the people and the temporal sovereign of the state. According to him, a law, in order to be a true law, must be directed to the common good of the people. The significance of this part of his political theory is that Marsiglio was not willing to allow this power approach to politics to be unrestrained by moral considerations. But the moral consideration that restrains the power of the state and what laws it will pass is a completely utilitarian one. Whatever is for the good of the people. If a law is not for the good of the people, then it's not truly a law. This has no recourse then to what? To the sanction of God himself. According to Marsiglio, the laws of the church, the canon law of the church, is really no more than the laws of a private club. They have no social standing or authority whatsoever. There is only one jurisdiction in the state, according to Marsiglio. Only one. You don't have church and state having jurisdiction in an area. There's only one jurisdiction, and that is the jurisdiction of the temporal authority, the state itself. A jurisdiction exercised in the name of the people as a whole. What distinguishes the state from all other social groups or communities is that it has power over the whole jurisdiction. It can issue commands that are laws because they are enforced upon the groups that are within the state. And these laws govern the clergy as well as everybody else. Okay, let's move on to another theorist. Was there a question that was budding out there? Okay. And look at Jean Bodin, B-O-D-I-N. '1530 to '1596. Okay, so this is a few years after Luther nails the 95 Theses. And what we see in the political theorizing of Bodin is the concept of sovereignty. Bodin was concerned that in some places in France especially there were among churchmen the idea that prerogatives that had been handed down by tradition could interfere with the uniform administration of the king's law in his country. So that he saw a case where the law of the king was to be enforced in a certain way in a certain province, but the clergymen of that province said, yes, but we've got an ancient tradition handed down to us that tells us that that can't happen. And so the judges refused to carry out what would have been the law of the king. They said, now, we can't have this going on. If you don't have uniformity throughout the land, if you don't have a uniform administration of justice, then you don't have a rational politics. Moreover, he saw the effects of the influx of Lutheranism in France. Here you have Frenchmen that are divided on this very emotional religious issue. Are the Roman Catholics right or the Lutherans right? And so you can understand why in this kind of setting that Bodin would insist that there has to be a single authority in the state that is powerful enough to draw together all the divisive elements. There has to be an authority that can establish law and order. Now, this uniform authority, this uniform law and order over a territory was given the name sovereignty. And I'd like to quote from Bodin. A state is a lawful government of many families and of what is common to them, together with a supreme sovereignty. We say that it is a lawful government in order to distinguish it from a gang of robbers or of pirates. However much such a gang may seem to form a society and its members to live in amity among themselves, we ought not to call it a society or state because it lacks the principal mark of a peaceful society, namely a lawful government according to the laws of nature. And so you have in Bodin the concept of the state having power, but also that power exercised according to a natural law, the laws of nature. According to Bodin, in the changed circumstances of the 16th century, the kind of political power that was exercised in the Middle Ages was not practical. Now we live in a day of religious dissent. And what did he think the sovereign over a land should do about religious dissent? I'm running a bit late, but I want to read this for you. I think you need to hear it. He says, I will not here try to determine which religion is the best and truest, though there can be but one truth, one divine law issuing from the mouth of God. But if a prince be well assured of his possession of the true religion, and if he wish therefore to draw his subjects to it, he should not, in my opinion, use force. For the more one tries to force men's wills, the more unwilling and stubborn they become. Except, therefore, when a dissenting sect becomes seditious, a good prince will not try to destroy it. For those who have been forbidden their own religion and who are disgusted with all other kinds become atheists, and after having lost their fear of God, they know no restraint and commit all manner of crimes and impieties, which it is impossible to correct by any human laws or other devices. The prudent prince, therefore, will remember that just as the worst tyranny is less miserable than anarchy, so the worst superstition is far less detestable than no religion at all. For in the reverent fear which religion awakes, there lies a mighty power for controlling a tumultuous people. Indeed, even atheists themselves agree that nothing is more useful in maintaining a state than is religion, and that it is the chief support on which the power of kings and princes rest. Is that encouraging to you? He says, don't persecute the religions. You can make good use of them, because religion helps keep people in line. People won't become anarchists. And so don't persecute, unless, of course, the religion becomes seditious. Then you may have to, you know, extirpate that religion from your land. But even though you don't agree with the religion, go ahead and let people practice their superstition. Again, we live in a day where people, this would just be, well, of course, that makes perfectly good sense. But what's this saying? The saying that religious piety is acceptable when it serves what? The purposes of the state. Religion is acceptable, even if you happen to think that it's wrong, because the higher consideration is that it promotes the peace and tranquility of the state. Yes, sir?
It just sounds like modern conservative religion. Mm-hmm. The Rush Limbaugh, the Ronald Reagan, you know, Buckley,
many times it is. I'm thinking Bill Clinton was not much of a practicing Southern Baptist until he ran for president. You know, and now he's just a good old boy, a Southern Baptist, you know. Well, but the problem is, as bad as what we're hearing here in Jean Bodin, is that at least he felt it had a true function. Religion would, if you will, domesticate the citizens and keep them as good pets of the state, keep them in order. In our day and age, it's become far more cynical. We use our religious affiliations just to get elected. We don't really care about the practice of religion, but we want to appear to be a good Baptist or a good Presbyterian or whatever it may be. Now, Bodin wanted to distinguish between the realm of fact and the way of justice, because he had this concept of the laws of nature. He did believe that kings should enforce the laws of nature. Let me repeat for you this distinction, this dichotomy, the way of fact and the way of justice. The way of justice is a matter of value. It's up here in one dimension. And then there's the way things really work, the way of fact down here. Kings should be interested in the way of justice, the natural law, but the state operates in the realm of fact. Now, how do we reconcile the exercise of power in the realm of fact? How do we bring it into some kind of alignment or connection with the realm of justice? Well, we're going to move on from Bodin, but Bodin felt man's natural reasoning enabled him to find the law and bring it to expression. As we move along in Western history and people are less sure that you can know the divine law, or that man's reason is competent, man's reason in the lower story is not considered competent to understand the things of the upper story, then naturally, what's the state going to become? More and more secularized, isn't it? And the way of fact is now cut off from the way of justice. And this brings us to Machiavelli. Machiavelli's dates are 1469 to 1527. As a date of flourishing, I would suggest 1513 with the completion of his work, The Prince, the one for which he's best known. 1513, of course, is just 4 years before Luther nails the 95 Theses. We're looking at conceptual developments, and the development of the idea of sovereignty, though it is chronologically later, obviously is not influential in terms of Bodine, but those ideas, you see, are circulating. And in the case of Machiavelli, you don't even have the restraint of the natural law. You have power politics, a completely naturalistic approach to political theory. Machiavelli is not disposed to consider morality when he looks at the state at all. The state is a natural institution, and all we are interested when we evaluate the state, all we are interested in evaluating is its efficiency. Does the state get the job done? And how can the state get the job done? Political theory is a means to end study. It is not a consideration of how the way of justice intersects with the way of fact. Machiavelli believed that the old virtues promulgated by Christianity, the virtues of humility and modesty and so forth, were in fact a detriment to the efficient operation of the state. The best prince is one that is ruthless and self-centered, one who expresses ambition and power. Ambition and power have no limit. Those who are ambitious, those who wish to gain power, will find once they have gained their preliminary goal, there's more power to be gained, more ambition. But they also find this, that they're, because of competition among ambitious men, the exercise of power must be exclusive. You can't tolerate somebody else having power in your domain, because that then puts some kind of crimps your style. It gets in the way of your own ambition. And so Machiavelli promotes the idea of the state and power politics. Machiavelli said men are basically stupid and irrational. They are not capable of governing themselves intelligently. They are ruled by passion rather than by reason. And particularly, there is this ambition, this passion in man. However, if everybody's allowed to pursue their own ambitions, if we have an anarchistic situation, you'll only have strife in the state. The only way to have then peace and prosperity in the state is to have a very strong king. But of course, Christian religion has corrupted what we know from nature, the basic ambition and power seeking of men. And so Christianity has become an obstacle for the state running efficiently. How do you like that? By exalting meekness and humility and otherworldliness, Christianity does not promote a strong state. Because in a strong state, you're going to get the most ambitious man to exercise his power over all the rest. And he'll be ruthless in that. Except Christians tell us we shouldn't be ruthless. But a good prince will be ruthless. The ideal prince is ruthless. Now, Machiavelli says, we could talk about an ideal situation where you have a government by the people. Because if you could have a government by the people, that'd be better than a government by a prince. But he says, you're talking fairy tales. Government by the people just doesn't work because of the nature of people. That might be nice, but that's not the way things are. This is interesting. And again, we take this for granted. In our day and age, when you talk about politics, if you get very idealistic, you try to get normative or prescriptive, here's the way it really ought to be. You know what people will tell you? They'll tell you, that ain't politics. You know, get real. The fact is, we're not going to live in that kind of world, so let's get down to it. But just think about this. Should we teach abstinence or should we pass out condoms in the public schools if we're worried about the AIDS epidemic? Have you ever heard this line of thought? Well, abstinence would be far better, but hey, in the real world, you better pass out condoms anyway. Well, that line of thinking, you see, goes all the way back and, of course, further than. But Machiavelli is right there. He says, oh, yeah, you can talk to me about what would be ideal in government, but I'm going to tell you what's real. And the prince must be ruthless. He must take his ambition to the max. I quote, the only way to establish any kind of order is to establish some superior power which, with a royal hand and with full and absolute powers, may put a curb upon the excessive ambition and corruption of the powerful. Machiavelli said, because the prince is subject to the same kind of irrationality and passions of the population at large, most princes will be tyrants. Yeah, he said, I accept that.